الإنشاليات التروبيكال تروبيك وبدأت President declared the Disaster Management Act and the company had to make sure that it was ready and we responded to that. Thank you. Next slide. This slide highlights our areas of success. As an organization, our target and aim is to leverage the private sector. So we, our aim is to, for every rent that we put out and invest, an investment in terms of FTTs and also loan funding. There's an entity called the Trust for Urban Housing. They $2 billion from the private sector. The NHFC owns 33% of that entity in shareholders. That's Housing Investment Partners. This is also one of the entities that the NHFC has a shareholding of 33%. Our 220 million has attracted private sector investment of 1.1 billion. What I would like to share with the committee in this instance is this was one of the piloting of a different product model whereby the repayment for a house is not based on the normal mortgage calculation, but here the repayments are based on the end user's salary and is adjusted with the salary increment. So in this instance, we work a lot with the employer. It's a very good product in that it deals with the interest rate fluctuation, because we know our market is very susceptible to interest rate fluctuations. It's a very good product that's doing well. We've invested in the International Housing Partner Solution, and there we've raised 1.8 billion that has been leveraged. Cape Town Community Housing Company is one of our 100% owned subsidiaries. We've now restructured it as they undergone a few challenges and is now performing under the NHFC as one of our units. So, the NHFC owns 20% in Lenco, and they focus on our incremental products, whereby end users are allowed to incrementally increase their house. One of the interesting developments is that Lenco is starting to be placed within the PEP store, and that will reach our end users very easily. Next slide, please. This slide, Chair, is just giving an outline of how we have deployed our capital, our total balance sheet. I won't go through the numbers, all of them. For example, incremental loans, 11% investment, private rental, 21%, social housing, 19%, strategic investments, the ones I just spoken to, 7% investment. Subsidy housing, it shows 0%, and I'd just like to explain why it's showing zero there. It is because at the end of the financial year, when we closed the books, we had 18 million that's sitting there as investment for subsidy housing. So 18 million as a percentage of 4 billion advances is very minuscule, hence it's showing a 0% balance. And also this product is a bridging facility product. So it will be what is outstanding as at the end of the financial year, not the money, the total money that has been invested. Thank you, CE. You may move to the next slide. This slide, Chair, is just indicating the footprint that we have made across the country as we operate at the national level. And I just really like to make the committee aware, and on hindsight, we will we have indicated the number of projects that we've invested at provincial level, and on the right column, it's giving you the number of incremental loans. Now, the reason I'm saying we're going to improve this is that this is only showing projects that are active as at the end of the financial year. And it is not a true reflection, because now we are not showing projects that have been paid off and they are off the books, but the investment is sitting in those provinces. So with the next round, we will show that, so that we reflect the full impact the MPC has had at provincial level. And it's also not reflective of the non-performing clients. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to hand over to the CFO. She'll talk through the finances. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair, and members of the Portfolio Committee, and to my fellow colleague. Just in terms of the statement of financial performance, I would firstly like to explain to the committee in terms of if you read through the financials, you will see that there has been a restatement of prior period results. The restatement is really as a result of the first time adoption of a new accounting treatment for loans disbursed to our equity and quasi-equity investments. And as a result of the accounting definitions, we have had to reclassify these out of loans and advances into investments in controlled and investments in non-controlled entities, which results in a consolidation of our investments in controlled entities. And a way that the reclassification is done as a prior period error per the GRAP financial statement requirements. So that's just to bring context to the restatements for the year. Just in terms of the group's surplus for the year, so we achieved 219 million. So this is primarily driven to satisfactory performance with respect to our investment income, to impairments, and to some of the cost containment measures that were applied throughout the year. Our investment income increased over the year from previous year, really as a result of more available cash on the balance sheet, allowing us to accrue more interest income. But really this was driven because we did not meet all our disbursement targets as we had anticipated. So in terms of our credit loss ratio, so our credit loss, as was spoken to earlier, came in at about close to 1.5%. And this is also a result of reversals from prior year periods for bad debts that were raised previously, of which obviously there were some rehabilitation that began to pay, so the bad debts were reversed, hence the reduced number. So just in terms of what negatively impacted our company profits, you'll see that there was a negative fair value adjustment on the company level in the current financial year. And this is really as a result of us having to write down some of our investments. If you appreciate with respect to accounting standards, our investments are valued at year end, but really for forward looking, right? So because we use a discounted cash flow method, as at year end, COVID had hit us as the rest of the world. And due to the impact of the uncertainty of the futures of the cash flows of our investments, as you can so imagine, as with all other banks, we've had to obviously take a fair value adjustment on these investments. So just in terms of, I'll just speak to the statement of financial position as well. So just in terms of our group lending book, it's currently sitting at about 3.6 billion, which is really the net book value, and the growth of about 1.2 billion in loans and advances from what you would have previously seen in the 2018-2019 financial year is a result of the inclusion of the quasi-equity investments, which are now treated as subsidiaries and consolidated. So previously, what we had given out through to Our equity investments is now on our loans and advances is now being consolidated into our group accounts. In terms of the debt capacity on the group level, and this has also increased from the previous 2019 year to about 1.4 billion. Again, this is a result of the consolidation of our controlled entities in the group accounts, which I spoke to earlier. The liquidity position of the NHSC remains strong. In the short-term balance of 1.1 billion, I think this leaves us in a very healthy position to be able to perform disbursements to achieve our mandate. In the current year, we received a capital contribution from the shareholder of about 50 million rand, which was received in the first quarter of 2019-2020. Sorry, I'm still on the first. I'm talking to both the first and the second, slide 13 and 14, so you can stop here. Thank you. And just to give an indication as well, in terms of the funds under management that we had not dispersed as at year end. So this is really for the SLIS program. So we had about 97 million on our balance sheet of about 97 million for SLIS, now 10 million rand for provinces. So these are the funds under management for which we have not dispersed, and these are included within our loans, in our cash and cash equivalents.
The person you are trying to reach is not able to receive your call.
In terms of the summary of the key findings of the Auditor General and the outcomes, I think. So we received an unqualified report with findings. So as a result of the restatement, this obviously is a matter of emphasis, but does not obviously change the opinion of the auditor, because they were in agreement with the accounting treatment that had to be undertaken. So the note of the prior period, like I said, was in line with GRAP. And
honorable members, do you hear the presenter or is my network?
We do hear, Chairperson.
Can I speak louder? Okay. Is that better?
We do hear, Chair. I think it's okay. Maybe is the connection on that side.
Okay. I'll proceed. So just in terms of some of the key findings that we had, so the financial statements that were submitted to the Auditor General included some errors. And these were obviously corrected prior to the completion of the financial statement. But I think one of the things from a reconciliation and review process, the entity is now formalizing that in terms of how we will be reviewing the information that goes through for audit to ensure that it reconciles to the numbers and that there are no subsequent changes after the initial submission. Another key issue was around supply chain, right? And this really was around effective steps that were not taken to prevent irregular expenditure. And this was really as a result of the continued use of contract after the inquiry date. So I just wanted to also just discuss a bit more about the irregular expenditure from previous periods as well and what we've done, because in the financial statements you will see that the 2018 and 2019 irregular expenditure has not yet been condoned by National Treasury. And the reason for this was that in the initial submission, the entity had not provided evidence that we had investigated the transactions and had taken any action against the responsible officials. This has now been done and corrected, and the investigations were conducted, and all the disciplinary actions were taken against the officials and the required controls put in place. So we then have resubmitted the 2018-2019 request for condemnation to National Treasury. And we are expecting that because we have met the requirements, they will be able to give us the condemnation as required. Just in terms, again, like I mentioned around the current year irregular expenditure, this is really, again, as a result of continued use of overdue contracts. So it's a mix of poor contract management, where we have contracts that have expired, but we are still in need of the service, and the suppliers are still being used. So a few things that we have done to rectify and remediate the issues are the following. So both the EXCO and other key officials within the organization were taken through training of irregular expenditure by National Treasury to ensure that both the officials understand what constitutes irregular expenditure, how irregular expenditure arises, and what we need to do to ensure that that doesn't occur. As well, we have procured a contract management system, which has gone live in the organization as of this month in November, to obviously improve in the management of contracts. So this system is really there to assist and alert us as the officials of the organization when contracts are coming up for renewal, when contracts need to be renewed in due time so that we can prepare ourselves from a procurement perspective adequately. So, and as well, just in terms of that, we are also reviewing all the contracts in the organization and putting and just putting the ones that need to go through a competitive procurement process, and we are currently doing that as we speak. And also as well, the SEM policy framework was beefed up as well, and this to obviously to just improve in terms of the supply chain processes and procedures, and this has been rolled out into the entity. Okay, just one, the last part in terms of information or requirements that were provided to the AG that were not accurate. I think, like I've said earlier, what we are going to be doing is improvement required in terms of the process of the annual financial statements, both from a financial statement and performance information. And the other finding that was there was just around the IT general controls. And these general controls are being addressed so that this finding is not recurring. Okay, I think that's it for my time. Thank you, Jay.
CEO. Sorry about that, I was talking to myself. Just towards the conclusion and giving a forward-looking view, and at this stage, some of us, of you might be aware that the draft bill is sitting with the state law advisors. It will be driven through that process that will go through to Parliament to be finalized nearing that stage. And in each one of those, as National Housing, we've had the opportunity to comment on them. So we're fairly satisfied in what's contained, unless down the line some things change dramatically. But we will have an opportunity once again to be able to make our own inputs. We are being geared to be able to deal with scale, hence our integration into all the strategic infrastructure projects driven from the presidential office. That tip that relates to human settlement in our target market to be able to consume as a bank. The other part is what has been already indicated, that in strengthening our internal processes, we're emphasizing technology development, creating platforms to make easy access by applicants sitting in every part of the country, but also to create efficiencies internally that we can drive our administrative processes efficiently. We want to make sure we are a bank of choice when it comes to affordable housing and human settlement funding, and try and create and orchestrate and advocate for developers, investors, and any other interest stakeholders to draw their attention and resources towards the segment market. We know that we can't do that by ourselves. We must strengthen strategic partnerships both with private sector and other international and local development funding agencies to enable us to deliver on the mega projects. Chair, I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, CEO. Before we go into the questions, we'll take another presentation from Shra. Shra, the chair and the CEO, you're welcome too.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. Members. I must start by just indicating it's myself and the CSM at the SHRA, Alison. I must deliver an apology on behalf of the chair. As she has arrived, and I don't know it, because she had indicated that she was going to call the secretariat to apologize because with the date changes, she was not able to be here today, and the deputy chairperson of council is in flight at the moment. So, Chair, if I can just table the presentation. Is somebody going to slide my presentation, or must I do it?
There's a lot of noise in the system. I'm not sure, is it mine or members, they have the same?
Yes, Chair, you're correct.
IT, can we get assisted, please? Proceed, CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. Right, Chair, let me start by just finding out, is the presentation on the screen in front of everyone?
Yes, CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, Chairperson, I'm going to share this presentation with the Corporate Services Executive at the SHRA, Ms. Tuane. I'm going to start it, and then she's going to take it from there on the performance information as well as the audited annual financial statements. So the presentation is going to cover the overview and the highlights for the period. And then after I've concluded with that, then Alice Poane will deal with the non-financial performance, the financial performance, and the audit outcomes. So, Chairperson, I think by now all of the committee members are very well acquainted with what the SHRA is here to do, and you know what kind of entity the SHRA are. And I've got a slide that will show you the four programs that we use to deliver our mandate, because we have to use the resources that we have got in a way that achieves a restructuring, developmental restructuring objective. So that talks to where we invest the money and who we use as conduits for the investment of the money. So, Chair, there are a number of values that the SHRA has designed that were presented to you once before, which drive this. And we use these values not just to write a strategic plan or to write an APP. We actually enforce these values at SHRA, and we have some fairly difficult discussions internally and operationally to make sure that the public gets the service from the SHRA that we are supposed to deliver by holding everybody accountable to these, call it, corporate values. We're not there yet, but we are a long way further in than we used to be in the past. As far as the programs are concerned, Chairperson, it's four programs. When Ms. Poane does the presentation, you will see that the indicators, the 30 indicators that fall in this reporting period, are broken down into the first program, which is the entire general management program, which is all the corporate services and support functions of the SRA, including, by the way, our objectives of trying to obtain a clean audit. And then the second program, Chairperson, is the program that is dedicated to transformation, and that's what we call sector development and transformation, where we have a budget of about 20 million rand a year to do capacity building and to incubate institutions and to help new emerging institutions to package their projects. And the third program, Chairperson, is the program that is dedicated to the delivery of the units. We call it project development and funding. And that is the program that has to not only ensure that the 50 odd contracts that are signed for delivering housing projects are concluded, but also that they are tenanted by the qualifying beneficiaries. And then the last program, which is also included on the slide, is the regulatory program, which is the compliance program that monitors the affordable rental housing landlords to make sure that they are delivering a good job. So I think the committee was already aware of a lot of those things. I want to go to the executive overview. First of all, Chairperson, the total number of units that are under the SRA's responsibility at the moment is approximately 40,000 units. The exact number to the end of the reporting period was 39,407. But every year it increases as we add more units, so it's already more than 40,000 units, and it has more than doubled since 2014-2015. The number of new units that we have constructed is 17,000 units, of which in the reporting period that we are reporting on in this annual report, the total new units added to the portfolio constructed and completed was 3,010 further units. Importantly, the amount of expenditure, because unlike in the past, we've got a lot more contracts signed now than we used to have. We have approximately 50 signed CCG contracts where we are at different stages of development of the units. And so in the reporting year, we have spent in that year, 2019-2020, more on capital funds than we have ever spent in any other year previously. So we spent 1.2 billion rand in CCG funding. And that represents 166% against the allocated budget. The next best year compared to that was the 2018-2019 period, where we spent 776 million, which is a lot more spending into the economy than way back when this got off the ground, 2014-2015, when only about 36 million was spent. The implication of this spending, Chairperson, is that it does mean that there is an operating deficit, which the CSM will refer to. An operating deficit, in other words, if you compare how much resources we spent with the 2019-2020 budget, approved budget, we did fund that operating surplus, we did fund that operating deficit from the retained surplus that Treasury had allowed us to retain because of contracts having already been signed in prior years. An important statistic, Chairperson and members, is the one in the middle of this page, is that although we spent altogether, if you add the operating budget and the capital budget, we spent close on 1.3 billion, it was 1.299, so 1.3 billion. Of that 1.3 billion, only 83.5 million was operating expenses. And this is a very important statistic for the committee to be aware of, because that does mean that the organization has a very low ratio, operating ratio, compared to total resources invested into the economy. Only 6.4% of what we spent last year was in the form of operating expenses. The total performance for the year was 67% for 2019-2020, And we had a total of 30 indicators that we reported on in the year. And of those 30 indicators, 8 of the indicators, which represents approximately a quarter of the indicators, were indicators specifically designed and dedicated to transformation. I remind the committee, and this is part of the reason why the operating ratio is so efficient, actually too efficient. I remind the committee that the SHRA is a very small entity. We only have, at the end of the reporting year, 47 staff. We have 6 vacancies at the end of the reporting year, which equates to a vacancy rate of 15%. And then, very importantly, Chair, before I move off this slide, is the fact that one of the concerns about the SHRA is that our systems are too complex. So one of the areas of progress that we made in the reporting year is an automated system using remote portals to be able to engage with applicants for accreditation using digital technology. And it's a system called MySHRA. It's not 100% up and running yet, but in the 2019-2020 year, a lot of advances were made. So Chair, the next few slides show the committee the trend over a total of 6 years, including the 2019-2020 period. So in the year 2019-2020, and you can compare it to previous years, the blue pillar on the top is the number of new contracts signed, and the mustard pillar on the right is the number of units completed. And the graph underneath it is the growth since 2014-2015, where we had 20,500 units under regulation, to now 39,500 units under regulation, which is pretty much doubling the portfolio. Chairperson, the next slide is the slide that shows, and it is in the annual report, which I believe the committee members do have, is that because of the fact that by the time the financial year ended, we had grant contracts for the construction of units that were signed, over 50 contracts. I think it was 52 contracts. And so naturally, with the lead out time on these contracts, as they were reaching their conditions precedent and some of them were breaking ground and reaching financial closure, the expenditure did increase quite dramatically. And that graph on the top shows you the year-on-year increase in the expenditure, which is about if you calculate it, is about a 100% increase year-on-year for the last 6 years. So that's very important. The graph on the bottom is what we have spent on what the NEF calls hand-holding, which is the incubation of entrants into the market, the capacitation, spending money on helping those entrants to do project packaging, and so on and so forth. So last year we spent about 16 million on capacity building and transformation. And then Chairperson, the next slide is the slide that talks to the amount of resources that we spent, where I said that we did incur an operating deficit. So I want to first start with what's on the top, the red line. We are back now at the end of 2020 to the remaining balance on the retained surplus that Treasury has allowed us to retain because of the fact that we had committed the funds. We're back to the same level that we were at in 2015-2016. So 5 years ago, we had a retained surplus of 544 million. The highest it got, that retained surplus, was in 2017-2018, when the figure was just over a billion. And with our increase in expenditure, it has brought it back down to 576 million. That is a good thing. It means that we're not sitting on money that's not sweating. The money is being invested in the economy, and that helps, and it creates jobs. It, though, on the other side, is also a balancing act that we need to watch, and the auditors have also pointed out that we need to watch it, because the total value of all the contractual commitments on the SOAS financial statements is a total of 3.5 billion if you add up all of the contracts that we've signed. So that's the balancing act. The graph at the bottom shows what that means. When we spent prior year's money, it means that compared to the current year's budget, we did have an in-year budget deficit, which is on the bottom, the mustard colors, the 413 million. So that's what that's about, Chairperson. And then Chairperson, on the staffing trends, I've really indicated that our efficiencies are very, very efficient. Percent operating costs compared to everything last year. Our biggest cost item is the cost of staff, staff costs. Our small staff establishment is not enough people, but it's what we can afford at the moment. And you can see that at least it's a vast improvement on where we were at in 2014, 2015, 2015, 16, 16, 17. So we've increased the capacity, and it's much better now, but it's still very, very lean. And then Chairperson, the next slide is how are we doing overall? Because Alice will go into the detail on the indicators, but how are we doing overall? We're not doing as well as we are aiming to do, but we are doing adequately well. The graph on the right-hand side shows you what percentage of our performance indicators that we have committed to Parliament on, we achieved 100%. And the total is 67% of those indicators were achieved 100%, which means 20 out of the 30 indicators in the APP, which represents 67%. 10 were not achieved. But Chair, I must just point out that a lot of them were achieved almost absolutely, but not 100% from an audit point of view. So that's where our performance, but we're not satisfied. It has to get to 100%. And then the last thing that I will say before I hand to my colleague, Chair, is the following 3 points. First of all, yes, the SRA does have an unqualified audit. That means we have an unqualified audit with matters, which is not what we're aiming for. We are aiming for an unqualified audit without matters, which is just referred to as a clean audit. And so we have an unqualified audit again. So we are on a journey and we're trying to get, we had hoped to have got there by now already and we haven't. So, and then the second thing, Chairperson, is on the second thing that I want to point out to the committee is on transformation. The interim council that oversees our work, which was appointed during this reporting period, the priority given to management by that council, the top priority is transformation. So that is why when Alice presents, you'll see that you have indicators such as the signing of the transformation charter by the regulated entities. Percentage of entities that we have put in incubation program that we have supported that eventually got recommended to the TEC for project approval, etc., etc. So, and we've helped them to package projects and so on. So that is a huge priority for the SRA, and even a stronger one in the new year, which you will see when you see our new APP. So Chair, those are the broad overarching comments. I'm handing now to my colleague, Ms. Pwani, and Alice, I hope you'll just tell me when I must scroll through, seeing as I'm sharing it.
Ah, the unmute button is on. Thank you, CEO. Good evening, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, including our colleagues in the human settlement sector. Chairperson, the last slide that the CEO presented indicated that we've achieved 7%, and then I'll go further into detail and talk to how the 67% is also made. It might appear unfavorable right now, but if you look at the number of targets that we have, it's 30, compared to the number of targets not achieved at all. It's full. So all in all, then, if you have to then classify them as partially fully achieved, we've actually achieved around 87% satisfaction. And then, CEO, we can go to the next slide. So Chairperson, the CEO has spoken to the audit outcome. I'm not going to talk about it now, but it's also a read. Overall, when we look at our performance, for the first time in about 4 years, we managed to have our budget variance below a target of 15%. And so this is indicative of the figures that have been presented by the CEO prior of the spending trajectory that the Shura experienced the year under review. And then further to that, Chairperson, we then have in the entire performance information table around four targets for transformation. Four of them are then black owned and then it's women and youth, including at traffic is all the designated individuals. And it is in both under OPEX, which is your normal goods and services, and the other one is under the capital grants. So on those four, we have managed to achieve, even overachieve at times. In supply chain management, we were quite deliberate, especially when it comes to the processes of RFQs, because we do have control over the service providers that we can approach. So we've deliberately targeted them, including all those designated individuals. However, we also have indicated that we also need a pipeline that is fully transformed. And Chairperson, indications are that the pipeline that we have currently indicates that it is transformed. I think 68% of all the projects that are in the pipeline are transformed. Chairperson, we also got to have our input in the social housing sector for the development of the MTSF right now. So on that one, there's no variance. And the next one, Chairperson, we didn't manage to meet the target of publishing, just the publishing of the annual state of the social housing sector report. That was achieved, though, Chairperson. The work was done behind because the development of the particular document, Chairperson, requires all the research pieces, requires all the stakeholder surveys so that you can input and be able to publish more scientific information than just a perception. And then the next one, Chairperson, students in housing accommodation. We didn't reach the target because of the way our target was a strong target. It was a question of having an approval from MINMEC, but didn't go to the extent, Chairperson. So in terms of the audit, and then we also did our stakeholder, biennial stakeholder perception rating. Following to this particular one, as you can next slide. We then went out of all the targets that we had, and say we managed to get 80% of it. And Chairperson, the stakeholder perception study for the search just gets the temperament of the social housing stakeholders that you deal with in order to address all the things that you are faced in most cases. The next slide, yeah. And then the next one is the number, is the percentage of SHIs and ODAs with units under regulation. We did manage to get benchmarks. So what assisted is our monitoring monetary pool and the interventions that we have through the capacitation guides. And from time to time, as we review the quarterly reports that are submitted, identify areas of weaknesses in the report and then come up with an intervention plan so that you can assist all these ailing SHI or delivery agents. That's a better way to say. And so, Chairperson, we are regulating in that manner, and it's a good achievement. It's an indication of us improving in our regulatory arm. And then the next one, Chairperson, then talks to the number of fully accredited social housing institutions. So, fully accredited in this case, you meet all the thresholds that are set. You don't have a problem as a delivery agent. But if you look, we have 13, our target was 13 fully accredited SHIs, and we've got 12, for just a margin of one Chairperson. And this in its own, it's good progress for the SHRA to then move in this positive direction, and also an indication of strengthening of regulation. You go the next slide. And then the next two, we look at the number of subsidized social housing units. So we look at tenant audits that were done. We targeted 3,300 units, and at least we managed to achieve 3,004 at the end of the year. And we've got all the indications of who are the tenants in these various projects that we have. And this also is evidence of our regulatory arm at the SHRA. And the following one, Chairperson, is the number of subsidized units, where we look at the building conditions. And say COVID-19 just made us miss it by a margin, because we had planned in the month of March that we would do the rest of the units. Unfortunately, we went into a lockdown and we couldn't then complete what was planned for March. And so if you look at these numbers and the margins, which included, except for the glitches, we could have achieved in any event. See on the next slide. And then we look at the number of social housing units accredited or approved for capital grant. We didn't do well at all. If you look at the figures, our target was 7,000 and we only accredited 4,860. When you look at the figures, Chairperson, it looks a bit gloomy. However, if you have to take into account the commitment that the SHRA has at the end of the year, which is 3.8 billion, and you look at the budget allocation that we get from the department of below 1 billion, it then presents an opportunity for the SHRA to then review and come up with a business case of how we're going to be able to then meet the obligations that are already on board. And in addition, we'll have this 4.8 and then try and mitigate so that we are able to deliver and not just commit and at the end of the day, we cannot pay. And the next one, Chairperson, then talks to the application received into the project pipeline by the conditionally accredited first-time application. So, Chairperson, we've been deliberate and proactive to ensure that the projects that get approved are ready, at least they meet most of the criteria, to avoid late project delivery, to look into factors that might also impact on it. So before we even take it into the project and consideration for approval, Chairperson, we use the incubation program that SDNC has, including the training and other interventions. So we will identify areas of weaknesses to assist all these applicants. And then when they are ready, we then put them through the pipeline for consideration of accreditation. Chairperson, we had eight projects that you identified, and we have six of them. The next slide, CEO. This one also continues to talk to CAR, which is a compliance accreditation regulation. We also looked at the transformation targets. This is what I spoke to earlier on, and saying 68 of the projects in the pipeline do meet more than 51% of majority black owners. And then the next one talks to the cumulative number of units under regulation. So Chairperson, there was an increase there again. Our target was 38, and we managed to have 39,000 at the end of the year under review. Chairperson, again, indeed, it is indicative of the increased regulation of the sector. And then the next one is the number of institutions brought under regulation. So Chairperson, these are projects that were not funded by ISRA, but were funded by the provincial institution subsidy. So this seeks to ensure that all social housing that were financed through government fiscals, they are regulated. So our target was 4, and we managed to have 5 under the under review. The next slide, CEO. And then the 2 here, again, Chairperson, we're looking at the percentage of pre-selected delivery agents that need support annually through a program in the pipeline. We had developed and submitted according to the social housing plan. So we had 5 out of 10 for this year. They were in the program, and indeed they are still participating in it, Chairperson. And the other 5 will be done in this financial year that we under. And the percentage of SHIs that received AIG, whose intervention were complete. So Chairperson, here we want to track whether those institutions that were capacitated and assisted by the SHRA to reach a favorable and acceptable level of performance, have they sustained it? Indeed, 2 out of 2 that we identified and assisted still have maintained their level of accreditation even at year end. Next one, yeah. And then we then look at again the amount of projects that are recommended for grant approval. 4 of 4 projects were recommended, so we managed to achieve 100% of this. And Chairperson, again, this is using our capacitation grant, especially those that have gone through the application process, and just to ensure that we expedite delivery of social housing, because we are lagging behind. The next one, CEO. You have lost your PowerPoint presentation.
Is it not on the screen, Chairperson?
It doesn't even move. Should I just continue without you moving it?
Is it on?
Can I proceed? Yes, proceed, but I've seen it has moved. I don't know. Oh, okay, there you go. Yes. Now, Chairperson, this one, it looks at the grant recipient, where they have adopted, Chairperson, the housing structure for transformation, the property one, Chairperson. We have an MOU, so that we can then outline and create a baseline of social housing codes, because we don't have one that is uniform. So we would be using together with the property charter person, and we managed to have 30 out of 53 of our grant recipients participating in it and endorsing that we have one. But as soon as it's up and running, we'll be able to then submit scientific clean tested figures because they have tools to do that for us. And then which talks to the next one, Chairperson, which is the baseline that we are going to be presenting going forward, because we don't want to present figures that are fluid or figures that can be tested. And the next one, Sido. Here, Chairperson, we look at the number of social housing completed. Our target for this year was 4,871, and we only managed to have...
Can you increase the pace, ma'am?
Sorry. Then we only managed to deliver 3,000 units per person. Various factors are there that we had challenging projects per person. However, at this moment, all those other challenges that were experienced by the projects, we have assisted them in the year that we are currently in. See you on the next one. And then, Chairperson, we then look at the target of tenanted units. Our target was 4,000, and we managed to then have 4,012 tenants that were housed at the end of the year. And the last one, Chairperson, is the amount that is divided between your social housing institutions and the private ones. Okay, so we managed, our target was that we allocate 25% of our CCG to ODAs. However, we only managed to have 9% allocated to them for the various reasons listed in their ticket. So, the next slide. I've spoken to these two transformation targets when I started my presentation. So we can move to the next one. And then, Chairperson, thank you. I will then move to our statement of financial position. What is key in this one, which we also spoke to about in the earlier slides, is that our cash and cash equivalents has reduced significantly compared to the previous year. The previous year it was 1 billion and now it's 660 million. And that effect is also seen in the accumulated surplus, because we are depleting the accumulated surplus by paying over the commitments over the year. We all can move to the next one. And then, Chairperson, here we just mention and remind that our grant was reduced from the previous year to this year, and our OPEX has increased by 2.2%, and we have indicated an operating surplus of 22.54 million. And there is also an indication there, Chairperson, if you look at the program cost that talks to the CEO's earlier graph that you presented, it has increased from 784 to 1.2 when you compare the 2 years, Chairperson. The next one, CEO. I won't talk to this one a lot. I'll talk to the next slide. It's just the movement in the net assets. And the cash flow statement, Chairperson, is also indicative of the increased outflow of funds when it comes to the program cost, meaning that we are paying in for the projects. And there's an indication that there's movement in them. And we hope that by the time we come back again, the number of social housing delivered will have increased, so that it makes the outflow of the cash. Okay. Next one, Lori. Chairperson, the last slide then talks to our audit outcome. We had three, we've got matters of emphasis. We had three figures restated in the annual financial statements, and that pertain to other income, provisions, commitments, and contingent assets. Contingent assets and income is the first time it comes up in our annual report, because for the first time we raised data to in the provision 1 relates to interest calculation that we needed to capitalize. Recall in the statement of financial position, we have paid together about 65 million. This chairperson was as a result that by the time of submission of our F, the final calculation of commitment and the interest capitalization was not fully completed, chairperson. And of course, when you start having your material misstatements, it says it's non-compliance with section 5 of the PFD. And chair, you'd ask how we then address this. Chair, we've managed to have separate bank accounts so that you don't do manual calculation of the interest. And we don't see or envisage that you can have a similar challenge again. And chairperson, given that it was the first time that you have met us, now we know how to deal with the complexities around recoverability and the legal process and the complexities presented by the legal process to recover the money. And chairperson, there was also a material finding on the usefulness and reliability of Program 4. Program 4 talks to the tenancy of the social housing units. What we need to do just need to have a system that ensures that the tenanting list is accurate. We have plans in place to address that one. And chairperson, the last one, our irregular expenditure increased substantially from the previous year, from 26 million to 225. However, chairperson, the reason for the sharp increase is two projects that were not in a restructuring zone. The first one, to date, the area, the location has been declared a restructuring zone, and the submission was sent to National Treasury for condemnation, as it was recommended by the council, together with the other one, the Free State one, which was waiting for the gazetted RVET. That was the last one, chairperson. And in the other 26 million, chairperson, we're still pursuing the recovery of that amount. It's also through a legal process. However, the CEO can just say how they can salvage that project, because there are prospects of salvaging the particular project. Chairperson, this audit outcome has to reflect how the SRA has performed over a period of 3 years. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. CEO, you want to close?
Chairperson, all that I would say in closing is that just also looking forward, as Susa had said, we pretty much, as the SRA, on the same page as the NHFC when it comes to the funding model. And the reason why that is because the economic constraints which will impede the increase in budget of reduced GDP in the country and reduced tax revenues for National Treasury to allocate towards this program means that we have to be innovative and that we need to work with the NHFC to move into a blended funding environment, to use the grant portion to leverage more from external financiers so that we can stretch the public rand further. So that's where our heads are at the moment as the SRA. And that is what is presently in discussion with the shareholder as well as with the SRA Council. So hopefully by this time next year, we will be able to show some progress in that direction to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. the CEO and your team. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the minister. Minister, you're welcome. come with members of the portfolio committee. Can I see the show of hands, honorable members?
Chairperson?
Yes.
Sorry for interrupting you. I was just trying to make you aware that my gadget does not have that raise your hand icon.
Okay, I'll note you, honorable member. Let me start with those that are in the gadget. Honorable members, we have honorable Mohlala, number one. That is the only hand that I see now. And then we'll follow it by honorable, new honorable Mokoto and honorable, okay, now their hands. Honorable Mokala, honorable Mokoto, honorable Leke, honorable Tafeni, honorable Seki, honorable Mbana, honorable Tri. In that order.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I'm going to be short. My first question is on program 4. We see there are targets that was not met under this program. So my question is, could the NHFC provide more details on the nature of targets that was not met, as well as the reasons for the error that was made in classifying the assets? Number 2, under NHFC, what are the reasons for the 10 million in private funds for enterprise development that was not mobilized? Number three, could the entity provide more details around the delays and challenges experienced at Kweasa and Kraken AIM program? Have these challenges been resolved? And the last, the other question is, it appears that 6 disciplinary actions were taken against employees. Could the entity provide more info on the nature of this disciplinary action? The last one, Chairperson, on NHFC. Many of our people suffer from bad credit records. They flip housing failed due to the fact that people don't qualify for financial assistance or bonds. The current system used by the financial institution in South Africa is discriminating against our poor black people. The financial institution in South Africa currently rates our people as being high risk or low risk clients in terms of their racial background. So my question is, I can see there is a potential of the new bank, the state bank. So my question is, will the state bank also discriminate against our people's financial records and risk, specifically in the poor economic situation that the country is currently facing? Then I go to Shra, Chairperson. On Shra, my question is going to be with regards to the Helder Vage Mega Project. My question is, why was there a sudden change of heart to use the same land for RDP housing? Because land was already approved for 903 social housing, walk-up units for Salamex, and funds were already ring-fenced by the Shra. apparently there is a project by the name of Helder Veg Mega Project in Brakpan. It just happened along the way that there was a sudden change of heart with regards to using that land. So we want to know what is the problem, why Shra changed its mind in terms of that. The other question is, was the land donated or sold to the province of Gauteng, since RDP houses are allocated free to the deserving beneficiaries? If it was donated, what was the donation agreement? And if it was, the land was sold, what was the selling price? The last question, Chairperson, to Shra. Did Shra issue a notice of non-compliance to social housing institution and remedial action after being informed of financial irregularity and governance issues? If so, when did that happen? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mosala, Honorable Mokoto. Thank you, Chairperson. My first question will be directed to NHSC. Effective and appropriate measures were not taken to prevent irregular expenditure, which amounted to 5.4 million rand. Why have you not taken effective and appropriate measures to prevent this irregular expenditure? In order to cap irregular expenditure, what effective measures have you put in place? And why has NHFC continuously ignored recommendations made by the AG to cap irregular expenditure? And then the next question, what measures have you put in place to deal with non-compliance with legislation in relation to internal financial control? The third question, the amount recorded for training and development decreased from 1.4 million in the financial year 2018 to 2019 to 1 million rand. In 2019-20 financial year, and from 1.3 million in 2018-2019, the amount decreased to 997,000 in 2019-20 financial year. What are the reasons for this decrease? Another question, what are the reasons for the construction delay by the SHI in Cape Town? Again, another one, the reason provided for the target not being reached for delivering 403 private rental housing units was the cancellation of Savannah. Could the NHFC provide more details on this matter? Another question directed to NHFC. The targets for bridging finance were not made due to incorrect forecasting. How is the entity ensuring that going forward, targets are specific and realistic to avoid targets being missed over incorrect phrasing or forecasting? My other questions are directed to Shra. Mm-hmm. What measures have you put in place to curb irregular expenditure? The second one, what measures have you put in place to deal with non-compliance with legislation in relation to expenditure management? Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson? Thank you very much, Honorable Mafoto. Honorable, okay.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Let me appreciate the presentation by NHSC and SRA Chair. We appreciate the progress or the performance, the good performance that especially the NHFC is continuously displayed, but I think there is a room for improvement, Chair. I think going forward, we are expecting a clean audit from the NHFC, Chair, because there are issues that were raised by AG, but I think the management has capabilities and a capacity to deal with those issues in the coming financial year, Chair. I think we must get a commitment that they will get a clean audit. And secondly, Chair, on the transformation targets, the NHFC has allocated 566 or 566 million was dispersed to BEE clients, but only 83 million was dispersed to women and youth, Chair. And I think their targets to women and youth was 348 million. So it means that we are far away from reaching that target. Can we get the reasons why this small amount of budget that was allocated or what was dispersed to women and youth? And not forgetting that women and youth are the majority in this country. And I think we have a responsibility as government, including all the entities of government, to make sure that we do empower them. And secondly, Chair, the amount NHF, I think my question will be directed to NHFC. The amount of legal fees, I'm not quite sure which slide was that, went up as compared of this year, 2019-2020, went up as compared to the previous years. My question, Chair, is what were the reasons behind that? And my other question, Chair, is on the slide that speaks to the footprints in provinces. When you look at Northern Cape, especially in the number of finance housing projects, you see zero. Can we get clarity why is Northern Cape performing so bad? Okay. And then the other, this one was raised, in addition to what other colleagues have raised, Chair, I think there were also delays in the construction of private rental housing project in Springs, in Gauteng, Chair. Can we also get the reasons for the delay of this project, Chair? My last question, or the two last questions. The AG raised an issue on NHFC continuously using the contracts even after their expiry date. I heard the presenter or the CFO saying, yes, this year they are reviewing all those contracts that were expired. But my reason was, what was the reason for that, for using those contracts even after their expiry date? Is this not opening a room for corruption within the entity? And then my last question, Chem, is on the Human Settlement Development Bank bill. The presenter indicated that the bill is still with the state law advisors, but I just want to get maybe just information on when do they think. I know this is the responsibility of the Department of Human Settlement, but I just want to get it from the entity to say when can we expect this bill to be presented to Parliament. I'm raising this matter, Chair, because normally the department will present their bills towards the end of the term, which will make it difficult for Parliament to process them. before the end of the term, although we'll expect Parliament to take shortcuts in terms of public hearings and consultation with all the stakeholders. So my question is, when do they think it will be presented to Parliament? Yeah, thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tseki.
Chairperson, just one question. The question is related to SRA. SRA is saying they are managing about 40,000 units. Off payment on those units. Are they happy with the state of risk? Are they managing? Are there no challenges where there are a lot of defaults? I know we are talking about 2019-20, but I can go for an example of now during COVID-19, many people have lost employment and then the risk become high. How are they managing that risk? Thank you very much. And just on a lighter note, I like how the Chief Financial Officer is presenting. She keeps on saying at least we have achieved 4 out of 5, at least we have done this and that. So she's actually giving a pat on her back before we even say that. Thank you, Chair. It was on a lighter note. Thank you.
We've lost Honorable Tafeni. Can we have Honorable Sehwai and ask those that have spoken to lower their hands?
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson? Chairperson, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Honorable Sehwai.
Okay, thank you. Just two questions from SRA, but in appreciation on the presentation, and I'd like that the SRA is very positive about the progress that they've made. That's why Honorable Tseki, she always say, at least they've done this and that, and which is towards a positive approach in terms of progression and trying to address issues that is confronting the entity. The government and the department has taken a decision to establish entities. The reason government is looking on who else can add value, because the problem of service delivery is huge. Let there be entities that will perform a business like to help government in terms of intervention towards giving service to the people. I listen, SRA is saying, we have made a business case of 3 billion, but government is giving us 1 billion. Now, I'm trying to check now, perhaps, do they understand? Do they understand? Because they seem to be stuck when the department is not giving them more. Without utilizing their financial muscle, to mobilize the resources. They get stuck, and therefore, some of the programs that they plan are not succeeding. Now, I'm asking the question, why SHRA gives up and is not attempting to get some other assistance from somewhere? The other issue, Chair, is that we expect SHRA to formulate an economic policy, because I think that's one of the issues that we need to get, because seemingly kufuneka lo mbele singaphumi into bona ngone sengenkabi engenanto. See, it's important that see what are the other variables that you want to bring in the fore, so that we appreciate your presence and your existence in the process. Ustak ba gada mali lomuntu lomsenga noba kasaphumi. The second issue, Chair, government, while we have got a huge service delivery backlog, but simultaneously as we keep houses, we've got to see transformation happening in the process. I listen that SHRA talks about transformation, but I'm trying to get the areas of transformation. And the most important one is that wherever you are, you must make sure that there's integration of the people of this country. Where you would see the racial integration, because there's no other way that you'll have government that continues to separate the people. One is interested to get perhaps a breakdown, in particular in Cape Town. One is interested to see a breakdown. How are you addressing, how are you unifying the people of South Africa as you give them services? There's no other money that's going to come to say, integrate them. Same money must do both service delivery, and then you make sure that you make the society to be one. So those are the few issues that I wanted to raise. There's a 6 million which has been a legal process. Maybe I missed that. I couldn't hear. I had some challenges of network at another time. I would like to hear a 6 million which was illegal. Where did that come, and then what are the processes to legalize that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Sasai. Honorable Tafeni, you are back.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on NHFC. Now, Chairperson, similarly, the auditor's fees reported in the financial statement increased from 4 million in 2018 to 2019 to 6.9 million in 2019 to 2020 group, and from 3.8 million in 2018 to 2019 to 6.9 million in 2019 to 2020 combined. They represent increase of 68.7%. and 80.3% respectively. What is the reason for this increase? Number two, both Neurofin Housing Proprietary Limited reported losses for 2018 to 2019 group and no income for the 2019 to 2020 financial year. Could the NHFC provide more details around this matter? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chafin. Honorable Seki and Sikwai, and can you lower your hands if you are satisfied that you have asked questions. Okay, thank you very much. I don't see any any hands, just to add one question.
Excuse me, sir. I raised my hand. Yes. I'm sorry, I don't know what has happened.
Oh, Honorable Vanna.
Yes,
okay.
Thanks, sir. Just want to comment in terms of those ones that managed to get the unqualified report. Yes, of course, that pleases us, but how we wish that it should be an unqualified with clean or with no other things. the other thing that I would like to raise is that
your network is very bad. I'm not
much as we hear this presentation, they seem to be very, very nice.
Honorable,
yeah.
Okay. Now, okay.
Did you hear me? The first comment.
Yes, we can hear you, proceed. Okay.
Excuse me. What I'm saying is that the reports are very nice crafted. They are crafted in a way that you will think that everything is fine. But maybe let's also commend the good work that they are doing, but at least they must also pull up their socks, because on the ground, in the level of the grassroots, some of other things that they are mentioning, we don't see them. I'm not going to just get deep into that. They know exactly what I mean in that. But those ones that have unqualified, yeah, we say halala to them, but they must try to get clean audit. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the network.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't see any other hands. Let me add some few questions on the NFHC. You know, I'm very worried about the explanation on the irregular expenditure on the use of contracts that had expired. As Honorable Becky has raised the matter, and the explanation that is given and how the entity is sought to resolve the issue. You procure the system to monitor the contract. You means that your project management is a problem, and now you procure the system, which you incur the cost to do what you're supposed to have been doing from the start, and it's a worrisome issue. And even the, it seems that you didn't even know that you could not use the expired contract. And I just want to check what is this issue, because I'm very worried, as Honorable Seke has raised, that it might be open for corrupt activities, because everyone would know that if you give people contracts at the end, you extend it legally, and you cannot allow a situation where it becomes irregular expenditure. But for the fact that irregular expenditure, as you attend to it and rectify it, it must be attached to individuals and before the condemnation by the National Treasury. It's something that make me easy on the issue, but the explanation indeed is worrisome, even the manner in which it was presented. The second issue is on the Just to understand this irregular expenditure on the IT general control, maybe I've missed something. Just to understand that because in the last financial year we had our hopes were raised very high that this year the NFHC will get a clean audit, and one is very disappointed even if you got unqualified audit with those matters. The other issue that we have been asking in terms of probably to address as we deal with the bill and the act at some point on the as because this bank supposed to intervene to make sure that those that they are not allowed by the system to procure acquire housing, then government will come in with his bank to help them. But the biggest problem that you have in South Africa is that particularly African people, they are indebted, and the group that are in the gap market are the ones, and I know that maybe just to ask the question on the there is a the PSA, which minister might know it, that has come up with the finance to assist public servants in general. How does the bank work with provinces with the PSA to educate and encourage those public servants to invest in houses, and whether the criteria that is being used is not the same as other banks, such that they'll look at your credit. If you owe Edgar, you don't qualify. So those issues probably they might be come into the bill and the act as we finalize the bank itself. But just to check for now, how does those that are indebted, are they, what is the criteria in the system that is being followed to assist? But at the same time, can we have a situation where there is cooperation between the NFHC provinces and the public service PSA, yes, with the allocation, because there have been a lot of various financial years that have passed, the money in that were not utilized, which government has available for public servants to invest in houses. So can the bank use that opportunity and partner with the PSA and mobilize public servants to invest in the property, particularly because it's something worth it to do that. Maybe through the minister, they can forge that collaboration. The other thing is with the last thing was with SHRA. Their intervention we can see and observe in the country in as a way of responding to the to the population, because South Africa houses and they might want to be into renting, just to check the footprint, because the footprint is in the provinces, as Honorable Zeki is raising. It seems there is no movement. One honorable member was asking with the around the Vembe area that you have a lot of students who does not want to stay in the availed accommodation for students, but we want a private rented houses, but there is nothing that you find there. She was saying that the rector there was saying that the planning of government, if it can take that cognizance that South Africa is young, and as you invest, you look even into the areas where the institutions of higher learning, your universities, because there are a lot of students who sometimes they don't need to utilize the accommodations that is available for students. They need more private areas to stay. So the footprint is in the provinces is very limited. I know that the resources are limited, but how do you make sure that there is fairness in all the provinces? The last thing is the target, 67%. What can we say about why not 100%? Those are the questions. Let's invite CEOs of NFHC, and then followed by Shra. And Minister, if you want to speak, you can just indicate. You're welcome to talk to honourable members. Can we start with the NFHC?
Thank you, Chair. I'll come in at the end today. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I will start from the recent questions and try and work backwards. I'm also with my colleagues on areas where I have not reached out. I'm sure they'll pick up from there. In respect of the bank's intention on serving the underbanked, it's typically at the center of why the bank is created. But to be specific around your question of over indebted clients, the intervention that the bank will aim to do is to work with partners and also assist those clients in respect of credit rehabilitation. Because quite frankly, it wouldn't be helpful to anyone if a client is over indebted and we continue to burden them with more debt. So one step is to enter into a structured arrangement and see if there's a mechanism to have those clients consolidate whatever they owe, have a structured arrangement to resolve, and then save them through the rehabilitation mechanism. It is the same as investing in public education programs. That's what the bank will position itself, that on an ongoing basis, we have campaigns to caution our people against over-borrowing or to promote better asset accumulation more than consumption borrowing and create value, and so that they can see the benefits of that. The other of the questions was relating to irregular expenditure. I think you were saying the explanation might not be adequate. Just a slight background. Some of these irregular expenditures are not happening because of necessity, poor controls. I'll give you one illustrative example where we are pursuing to restructure a housing administrative company by changing governance and ensuring that they structure the same properly. The legal firm that we use happens to know the history of this institution, and it knows the nuances and complexities of the contract. And so, as the law, you say the wheels of justice grind very slow, by the time you come to conclude and close on that matter, the term on which that legal company has been allocated, you find it has gone past. But the reason you deliberately continue using them is because they've got institutional memory and knowledge of the complexities of that issue. Rather than to go back and retender and lose money, you continue to use a similar platform. But then you will find cracks that, because you're wanting to move fast, there might be no time to go back and retender. You document and seek for condemnation, and the turnaround sometimes catches you up. In the case that was explained by our CFO, when you put three institutions together, the numbers of contracts you manage almost quadruple in one way or another. And you find we bring different systems and methods in managing those contracts. So in trying to streamline, few things do fall into cracks. So it's not like there was never a project management system to manage your contract, but I think the manner in which they just increased in number pushed the system out of kilter. That is why the best solution was to acquire an automated system that typically will block you from using a contractor or service provider if it's out of a contracted period. So the system is not a reflection that the project management systems have not been there. It's simply trying to streamline some of them. And I want to believe that as we move forward, there will be less and less of these findings moving forward. We always aim that there should be no findings in our control environment. What I manage mostly is there shouldn't be repeats. And even those that could have happened, they should not have been deliberate or as a result of people not giving due attention to the job that they do. And if you find those examples, I think consequence management kicks in. So we really strive to have clean audits, but sometimes it's a very difficult or a moving target to some extent. From Honorable Mbana, yes, we have good presentations as you suggest, but what about on the ground? This is the challenge always and everywhere in the world, that when you run an apex institution or a wholesale institution, its line of sight and visibility to the ground is not always obvious. But there is a reason from a policy perspective that the wholesale institution is able to marshal and rally multiple institutions that themselves in their own right touch a number of people on the ground. You do that multiplier impact through a wholesale model than if you were to try and retail, and to bring that contact with people on the ground will be very costly and typically take you many years before you reach full impact. So yeah, there's always a challenge that how do you make sure those who are on the ground feel where the assistance comes from, but also it is provided in as efficient fashion as possible. Then there was a question from Honorable Tafene on the audit fees. To the best of what I know, it's also driven by the historical audit fees were one single institution. You now have three. So the number of accounts the auditors have to audit have increased. But over and above that, there were special audits which were linked to the merger. Things like auditing the what is called opening balances before you put balance sheets together. It's a very detailed exercise that, and they are once-off initiatives. Those are the things you do only at the beginning of the merger. They don't repeat themselves. So you'll find the scale-up of the audit fee informed by the number and volumes of accounts to be audited, and then the special audit assignments that had to be done. Others are driven by us or management requesting specific audits or opinions in areas which might be new from where we come from, as we mentioned, moving forward, or issues that are being dictated by the new financial accounting standards, etc., etc. But with our audit committee, I'm very convinced, they put a very strict eye on audit fees from two angles. It must be a budget that gets approved in advance, and they ensure that that number is maintained, and it has to be approved by the shareholder at the AGM. So they really put scrutiny, and our auditors will attest to that, that they don't have an easy way out. The other increases are mainly driven by the inflationary aspect, which I'm not going to be emphasizing. On the status of the bill, where is it sitting? Yes, as we said, state law advisors. It's a hard call to say when will it reach Parliament, because it reaches a certain stage of iteration, including, I think, invitation for public comments, etc. So I think it was acknowledged that it's not entirely within us, NHFC, to control that process. But from the feedback that we gather on a monthly basis from the department, is that the original aim was that by November, December, at least it should have moved to Parliament. So it needs to be caught up in a cycle. Apparently, there's other bills that already have been lined up, which are ahead of the HSDB bill. So it's hard for us to give a very specific answer there. Honorable CNK, I think some of your issues have already dealt with from the clean audit point of view. Then you raise the issue of disbursement and then the extent of support to women and BEE. We really remain committed to increasing a portion of our disbursements to women and BEE. The recent Women in Construction conference that was organized by the department was a very good opportunity where we could physically meet with groupings of women formations who have set up appointments to come and show us their projects. And there's a very rich exchange of information of how they need to package their applications, package their programs, and ensure they are capacitated to succeed. But we've made sure as well that amongst our staff, we create a dedicated individual who will simply ensure he looks at all these opportunities that come through, that they have a component of women, either being champion from inception, or even if they are large ones, they must demonstrate to us their ability or intention to support women downstream in one way or another. So it's a very serious commitment. The board wants us to account to them on a monthly basis and do a portfolio analysis on a quarterly basis on the progress that we're making, not just women, but the whole Black empowerment objective. Why have the legal fees increased? Very difficult to answer, but at a high level, sometimes you find contracts which were approved in the previous year overlapping to this financial year. And therefore the fees which in essence could have been charged in the previous year get charged this year and makes it look as though from an attribution of which applications have you approved, why has the legal fees increased? They are simply linked from that overlap. Others, when you set your conditions before you make disbursements, you might find one of the conditions is to register or to ensure that the pieces of land is made available, in which case, when you are given a document to certify that, you need an opinion from a legal mind that the documents you have to sign or ask to sign are in good standing. So there's quite a number of areas where we have to go to outside firms in capacity to get assistance on legal matters. Provincial footprint, there's one which shows a zero. I think my colleague tried to explain that it's a presentation issue more than the fact that there's a zero presence of national housing in Northern Cape, for instance. Historically, there are projects, but most of them have been closed because they're fully throttled down and they are functioning. Whereas the slide was looking at currently active projects in the sense that they are currently under construction, etc. Hence, you are saying in future when we cast or provide the presentation, we need to show the dimension of history as against looking at only active ones. So Northern Cape is not ignored or is not by any deliberate intention. Yeah. bridging finance targets and what can we do to be more accurate? Again, it's one of those difficult calls in that the amounts and the volumes of on residential project construction are normally a following indicator in that where there's economic activity, where people flock for settlement, then they generate that kind of activity. So if you were to predict what's going to happen in the next 2 to 3 years, your best bet is to be informed by history more than science and very precise prediction of what, how many of these bridging finance projects you're going to get. The other is, even if you were to know which areas and pieces of land where the opportunities will emanate from, it's not like all of them would be processed through our own institutions. There are others who are funded by other development finance institutions, so not everything can be consummated from our side. So we try by all means to predict. Things don't necessarily happen in that fashion, given, of course, the fluid nature of the economy. Number two, it is the extent to which the project itself performs on the ground. Some have got delays beyond the project pioneer's control, in which case you don't disperse at the time that you thought you would have liked to disperse. So it's a very difficult target to meet, but we try by all means to make sure that we are closer to those targets. Then there's SHI delay in disbursements from Honorable Mokoto. I don't have specifics, but in general, for instance, there are specific conditions precedent that are set when a project begins. And the few that I've seen is, for instance, where the land had to be subdivided to accommodate a specific housing construction. At the time when we get ready, those processes have not been completed. Or if the specific securities to be registered or mortgages to be registered, there are slippages. So processes do not necessarily happen at the time that you would have predicted. So that's why you will find an approval of this year does not necessarily have be drawn down in the same financial period. It sometimes overlaps to the following year. But if really there's a specific issue around SHI, I'm more than happy to come back and write to the community, to the committee. Staff training budget has decreased. I cannot hide behind the fact that I'm acting. I was not there before. What I've seen this year is a rapid jump of training, more than 27% increase in all sorts of areas in training of our staff. And so much that I was delighted. Now, when there's a finding that historically we've been bad, I'm more than happy to go and investigate. But I can only guess in terms of, you know, when you put institutions together, some of key issues that should happen, because you've got so many balls up in the air to be handled by leadership, some things get neglected. And in the hierarchy and ranking of risks and which aspects to manage, not that it's a good thing, training does get relegated to some extent. So I wouldn't have a good answer for you there. Honorable Mokoto also says we could have been effective in the 5 million irregular expenditure. Indeed. But I think I've touched on that already. That the manner in which these happen, it's not because typically or always somebody has been flipping on their job. It's the nature of the transaction and the manner in which we want to speed up our turnaround in servicing our clients or even managing our risk so that we don't lose money any further. Hence, when we apply for coordination, finance normally would have an understanding of that and approve. Where there's a need to take disciplinary action, for instance, the individual that is responsible for that expenditure did not seek the necessary authorization before spending. So even if you know there's an agency, the time is going to expose the institution for going out on tender. You need to get upper level authorization up to CEO level and then continue and expand. In all those instances, NHFC has taken the consequent steps that must be taken. From Honorable Mashallah, there was an issue around FLISP. discriminate in poor economic areas or in supporting people who do not have sufficient collateral. If you look at FLIPS, its main intention is really to support people who've got weaker equity contributions in their borrowing. Where it's got its structural weakness is we still follow through and support people who have been approved by the bank. And so what does that mean? The bank will apply its normal criteria of creditworthiness, affordability, etc., then come to us where there's a shortfall on equity contribution. I think it does enormous help. But as we move forward, we're in dialogue with the banks to find mechanisms of how to continually increase the participation and also the efficiency within the scheme. One of the outcries I know is that they're saying they want to be permitted to allow mortgage bonds that they've been registered but for a period of less than 3 months, because our rules are such that if it's more, it doesn't qualify. Because why? We're trying to find people who are first-time borrowers. The other question from Honorable Mohlala was, there are 6 disciplinary actions on staff registered. To the best of my knowledge, of the ones I've had sight of, they do relate to poor conduct, individuals who in some instances have been absent from work for extended periods of time, unexplained, and to some limited extent, even performance. I don't want to read that as abnormal, in the sense that the philosophy we're trying to drive is that we must be able to check performance and ensure that the bottom, at least 5 to 10% of poor performance, must be deliberately managed out. That's the only way you lift performance. Because if you're gonna leave and sit with people who are dragging their feet, the culture pulls itself down. So some of these disciplinary actions should not be viewed as and negative in nature. It's a mix where the institution is trying to put itself into a correct path. Yeah, I think those are the ones that I can tackle. But I don't know if my colleagues would like to add anything more. Thank you, Chair. Hello,
thank
Chair.
You. Thank you, CEO. You're welcome to those that want to add on what the CEO has done.
Good evening, Chair, and members, and Honorable Minister. My name is Viwe from NHFC, Viwe Gweta. There are 2 questions that were also raised by the Honorable Mashallah, relating to ESD, which is Enterprise Supplier Development, and a target that was not achieved of 10 million. Just to give a context to explain the intention there, there are a number of these initiatives to try and create a conducive environment for new entrants and smaller enterprises. One is on the lending side, and the CEO was indicating that sometimes the lending side, you get clients that are already appointed by other players in the market, and therefore you are a taker in that market as a lender. But on the other side, we are also trying to be proactive and partner with provinces and municipality to say, let's work with them to structure programs that make it easy for small enterprises, small contractors, women and youth-led contractors to enter and implement programs in a fashion that unbundles the project to allow for small enterprises to graduate to that program. Some would have been subcontractors but missed the opportunity of taking a scope on their own and implement. So we reach out businesses that are trying to absorb and create channels for smaller enterprises and new entrants and give them support. And what we find is that for those enterprises, it is not just about financing. There are a number of areas that you have to help them with and support. One area that is important is that sometimes the bridging finance that we provide compensates for inefficiencies in how payments are administered speedily to pay small contractors on time so that they don't need to raise a loan in order to buy material or pay suppliers. And therefore, we try and make sure that we partner and make sure that the payment flow is speeded for small contractors so that they always have cash flow. Help them get access to credit with the suppliers so that they don't have to pay upfront for material, and they can create a credit facility with material suppliers so that they can get on site. There are areas of technical capacity that we do training in partnership with NHBRC. We've had good collaboration with NHBRC in training home builders. There are areas of management training. Sometimes some of the contractors would not produce management accounts regularly, and therefore they can't assess their performance, whether their project is making a profit or no profit. And sometimes to have that training and support by an accountant that can work with those players is another area of intervention. In some instances, and we realize that enterprise development also, there are funds that need to be invested in these initiatives. And as the entity, we're prepared to invest in that, in those areas and raise funds. And those funds, if they can be raised as grant, they get raised from the corporates. And the enterprise supplier development and the reference to the 10 million was the intention to find corporates that have got these budgets, that have got alignment of goals to develop contractors. And sometimes development of contractors, it could be about creating a particular, it may not necessarily be just contractors, it could be developers as well that are new entrants. It could be about investing in a system that gives them a leap in terms of entry in the industry, and they have access to technology that is used by their counterparts. And therefore, that 10 million target was an intention to partner with corporates that have got those budgets and alignment with the sector in terms of developing contractors. And whilst other aspects have shown some good intervention, some traction, this area we've not been able to register success as yet. But it is something that is not, it is still on our radar screen. I think we were slowed by processes of trying to gear the company to be ready to build partnerships with the private sector and parties that have got shared goals with us. And it remains, whilst we underperformed on it in the year under consideration, but it is still remains an area as a source of financing in terms of partnering on enterprise development. It remains that goal, but we acknowledge the underperformance in that regard. Then the other question was related to delays in Kuyasa and Drakenstein. Again, this program is similar to what I outlined. It is a program that seeks to unbundle scopes of work for smaller enterprises to enter and be active in the economy and where programs are implemented. I think in the structuring of this program with the Human Settlements Department in the West Cape. In the structuring of this program, the department retained the portion of the procurement. So our planning teams would go into the program, unbundle it, create smaller scopes that will go out for procurement in the localities to access small enterprises. But once those enterprises that need to be participating have been given the scopes, they still needed to be submitted back to the department for decision making. And those decisions have been slow in some instances. That was one variable in terms of the dislocate of procurement. Whereas when you run small enterprise development programs of this nature, you want to make sure that decision making is made in with speed. If there are payments that need to be done, they are done with speed, and you don't break down the system because of many players that are playing in the process. And it was a lesson that created an efficiency in the process. The second one, it again relates to decisions where the communities in their participation would contest certain scopes as they get broken down. And once there's that contestation at a community level to the community structures and the facilitators, ultimate decision making of those scopes in this process where procurement, portion of the procurement remains with the client, still needed to be taken as decisions. And those small delays, cumulatively, they created delays in these two programs. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, through you, may I just add two, three points that I'll just add on my what my colleagues didn't cover.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Chair, I'll just respond quickly to the training. The question was why training had dropped. And just to say to the committee that 2019-20 was the year when we were regrouping and planning because we had just consolidated. And we came into a situation where we had duplication of roles because it was three companies merging with roles that were duplicated across the board. So training went down because at that time management took a decision that we train people for positions that are going to occupy, so that it's an investment for the company as well. So the reason training went down just because of that. We were still dealing with duplication of roles and placing people into the roles that they are qualified for, and this was post the skills audit. Now, Chair, to the question around disciplinary action, the six disciplinary actions that are reported in the annual report, four of them are around the irregular expenditure, and this is really just a decision that management took that there should be consequence management. So employees were disciplined, and the other two are dealing with non-disclosure and negligence, and one of the employees absconded, so hence they had to be disciplined. Around the issue of student accommodation, Chair, yes, it is a new product for us, and I must say to the committee, we are sitting in a situation where we have 66 million approved, and it is in the disbursing phase, and that project will be completed in 2021, and the other 2 million is still new. So that is one of the areas where we are improving, and student accommodation has become one of our focus going forward. And Chair, the last one around the footprint, the CEO did touch on it. In the past, when we did the footprint analysis for our integrated report, we just showed the dots which indicated where the NHSC has had investment in the past. But in trying to bring in more meaning and say what type of investment they can relate to what we are saying. We did, as I said when I was doing the presentation, on hindsight, we realized we only reported projects that are active and not the investment that we have done. So going forward, we will cover, even though the project is fully dispersed and it's out of our books, we will report on that as yet to date. In the Northern Cape, our subsidiary in Cape Town has had projects there, and they did develop those projects. We've had one project called Space, though it didn't succeed, but there are projects that did happen in the Northern Cape. Thank you, Chair.
So if I may, just to add on one point that was not covered.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think just around the question on Nurofen. So Nurofen, as we see in the financial statement, has remained in the current amount has remained from 2019 to 2020. So just a bit of background around Nurofen. Nurofen is one of the NHSC's investments where we had to invest in a social housing venture. But this venture has essentially been written down to nil, hence us maintaining it at the same value. But it essentially has been written off. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shara.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good evening again, members, and good evening, Minister. Chair, there were 10 questions that were asked to the Shura. I'll start the order that they came with the Helderwijk project, which is the Salamax project near Carnival City in Ekurhuleni. Chair, there has been no change of heart from the Shura. What happened there is that it was an applicant called Salamax. Salamax was a grant applicant created by the landowner, a company called Purple Moss, and they formed a venture and the partners fell out and Salamax lost their rights to the land. And when Salamax lost their rights to the landowner was not negotiable on reviving the land availability agreement. Don't forget the site, as you correctly said, is within the mega project, one of Gauteng's mega projects. We as the SHRA tried to mediate between the warring parties, and that mediation failed because the relationship between the parties has collapsed completely. And because one of the warring parties is the landowner, there's no way to go with it. So the only thing that we can do is to recover our remaining 7 million in the project. There have already been 3 questions posed in the Gauteng legislature on the same matter. We don't have any knowledge about the land subsequently being sold to the province. So I can't answer that part of the question. And if it has been sold, the SHRA has no knowledge of that. So I don't know how much they would have paid for it if it was sold. And then, Chairperson, the second question is about the issuance of compliance notices for irregular expenditure. I think the question was compliance notices where there has been either irregular expenditure or irregular activity. In all cases where there is irregular activity, where the grant applicant or the social housing landlord on their quarterly reports to the SHRA are not doing a good job and they become non-compliant, we always issue non-compliance certificates. In the case of the irregular expenditure, the reason why we didn't issue non-compliance certificates is because the responsibility for gazetting the restructuring zone rests with us, not with the grant applicant. So it's us that had to correct and get the zones gazetted. which, by the way, the good news is that has happened in the case of the one irregular expenditure in Gauteng, and that has now been gazetted and the matter is resolved. In the case of the Free State restructuring zone, it's very far advanced, but the grant applicant in any event has repaid the bulk of the money invested in the project. So it's back with the SHRA, 41 million. I think they owe us another 14 million. And so that's how those matters were resolved. And then the third question was the measures that we have taken to curb irregular expenditure. It's a bit unfortunate because the irregular expenditure related to the fact that the restructuring zone did exist. Yes, it did exist. However, because it was in a metro, we have council policy that allows us to approve a project within a 10-kilometer radius of the restructuring zone. That does exist. But what consequently the lawyers advised us is that even the 10-kilometer radius must be published in the Gazette. So the measures now are each and every time we have any expenditure against an accredited project, it first has to be signed off by our legal unit, who has to state in writing that it's 100% compliant with legislation, and then we should not have a reoccurrence of this problem. On the default rates, that was question number four, it is a bad picture. Up until the end of last quarter, the average collection rate across the whole of the 40,000 units had sunk down to 67%, which is very, very bad. Fortunately, there has been some improvement, but not back to where it ought to be. And also, fortunately, the rent relief policy has been approved. And as recently as last week, the required regulations under the state of disaster have been formulated, and we're anticipating that they will be published in December, and then we can start dispensing the rent relief to try to help tenants who have lost income. So that's question number four. And then question number five was about the use of the government grant. SHRA mustn't be crying about not having enough grant. We must use the grant, leverage other money. That is absolutely in line with the current discussions that the SHRA and the SHRA Council and the shareholder, the department, is having. That is the reason that the SHRA has pitched projects for the infrastructure fund through the SIDS program. And that is also the same reason why the SHRA has been having wide-ranging discussions with a range of financiers, to name but a few, PIC, DBSA, Rand Merchant Bank, and Sasfin Bank. And it's for the reason that member Sishwayo has mentioned, that we must lend the financing. We can stretch the grant further by using the grant to leverage more. So I have an, it's work in progress. And I must say, the SHRA also hosted an investors seminar, which was very well attended by financiers, 300 participants in the investors seminar. And that was on the 29th of September. And there's been a lot of activity since that seminar from interested financiers, including, by the way, international parties. So the member's quite right. And then on the transformation, the member has given a new idea, because you're talking about racial and social integration. All the provinces have different demographics when it's split between categories. At the moment, we do not prescribe percentages of how many African tenants, how many colored tenants, Indian tenants, white tenants. And so it is true that in the different provinces, the profiles are different based on the population demographics. But perhaps the SHRA needs to be more directive to make sure that the profile of the tenant body mirrors the demographics of the area, if that's what the member meant by transformation and racial integration. We would just have to provide a guideline, and I must admit, we're not presently providing that guideline. And then question number seven. It wasn't 6 million that was irregular, it was 26 million, unfortunately. It's a Gauteng project based in Soweto, and we are in the process of recovering this 26 million through legal processes because the grant recipient misled the SHRA and did not disclose the status of their land availability agreement and did not disclose that they were in dispute with the landowner. And we commissioned a forensic. So as you know, with irregular expenditure, you either regularize it, which is what we're doing with most of it, because it's easy to regularize, and we must get it condoned by Treasury. But this 26 million, we're not planning to regularize it. And that is advanced in the legal process. And then question number eight was really a statement, and the SHRA agrees with the committee. We must obtain a clean audit. There are only three areas that stand in the way of a clean audit. The one is just last little remaining tail end of supporting evidence on the performance information. The second one is material misstatements on the annual financial statements, which is highly unlikely that it will happen again, but the CSM is here. I'm sure my colleague will comment. And the third one is the irregular expenditure, which we are presently regularizing. So I hope if we regularize that and we recover the 26, we have a good chance of a clean audit. And then the last two questions. The one was on student housing. It's true what the member has said, and a lot of our projects are located in close proximity to tertiary institutions. And a lot of students do in fact qualify to apply and do apply. We have a proposal that we have submitted to the shareholder to allow us to specifically roll out some social housing projects in particular locations that will be taken up by student beneficiaries. But we can't just do it and then have another irregular expenditure because we're guided by policy. So the policy changes that are required to fund student housing directly must first be approved. And then the last one, question number 10, before I ask for you, Chairperson, if Alice Poane wants to also comment on some of these questions. The last question was, why not 100%? So that's the second question that's really got me thinking here. We've never claimed that we thought we could achieve all of our indicators 100%. And the reason is that we have always announced that we are aiming at a benchmark of 80%. So we're presently 13% short of where we're trying to get to. The reason why it's difficult to promise the committee 100%, we do have dependencies. We have don't forget the SHRA is not the landlord and the SHRA is not the developer. So we rely on the performance of the social housing landlords and consent. While we can think about it a bit more, we are using the Auditor General's guideline of striving for 80%. Chairperson, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Members of SRA, you want to add from what the CEO has raised? You're welcome to do that.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. The CEO has covered all aspects and his answers are comprehensive. The only one that I just want to augment is that the financial misstatement transactions were treated by us as annual events because they're disclosable items. So what we're going to do now, we're going to track them on a quarterly basis as we conclude our quarterly reports. So in that way, we will ensure that when it comes to year end, we are ready and above board. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Chair, I think that we were able to get most of the answers to the questions that you have asked. There remains about two or three questions that were not responded to because they fall possibly outside of the scope of the entity themselves. The question was, when will the bill come to Parliament? And I think the next question would have been why they took so long. The bill will come to Parliament when it has been finally certified by state law advisors. And I am informed that it has now been certified. And on the 9th of December, it will serve before the DG cluster. Thereafter, it will be handed over to the minister, who will then put it before cabinet. And once it has been approved by cabinet, it will then be handed over to the portfolio committee. So we are hoping that it will, if we're lucky, we could do this before the end of the year. But I am happy with the progress that we're making in the institution. As I indicated, I think it's our last interaction with the study group. I am still looking forward to us hosting a farewell, thank you and farewell function for the former CEO of the bank, Samson Murapa, I'm happy to report that we had our first AGM today and it was a great success. On the matter of the bank, I am hoping that at some point we can discuss with them the possibility of how they can assist with the government employees housing scheme. This is something we've been asked to look into. As you know, part of the package of the negotiated settlements that have been reached with the public servants is a government housing scheme. This has been in the pipeline for the last, I don't know how many years. We have not found a home for it. And I don't know if the bank would look into this and see if it fits in with their own mandate. If not, we will have to look for somewhere else to locate it. But the government employees housing scheme is part of our responsibilities. Then on to SRA. The question was asked about the racial demographics. It came to my attention. I don't know whether the member who asked the question was at a meeting, but it came to my attention through my deputy minister, who had gone to a public meeting in the Western Cape. And the biggest gripe that the people in that particular meeting had was the fact that the social housing institutions are predominantly white, and therefore the people who are provided with the social housing in the Western Cape are predominantly white. I'm glad to hear the CEO now indicating that they're going to look into it. I think they need to have a quota. There needs to be a quota for every social housing institution. There needs to be a quota. The Western Cape is not predominantly white. Actually, those people who need housing is predominantly black. And therefore, there should be a quota for every social housing institution, wherever they may be, that they've got to cover all of those groups that we're talking about. Part of our job
is not only to provide housing, but to integrate people, integrate our communities, so that ultimately we achieve the purpose of having one country, one people, who believe in the one constitution. And I'm glad the question was asked, and I'm glad that the CEO is going to look into it. I would like that there should be a target set. If they don't have within their vicinity any black people, they would have to go and look for them. Otherwise, they do not qualify to have funding from SHRA. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister, and the team. I think the team has responded to all the questions and very clear and to their best ability. And thank you very much. They were very clear on their response, and want to thank all of you for having responded to the question in the manner that you did. It was even more educative at some point to some of us. Thank you very much. Honorable members, if there is no any other question, I must take this opportunity to thank honorable members for having engaged with these two entities and having much more time today, and the discussion was very fruitful and empowering. And thank you very much. And I want to say thank you very much, and the meeting is then adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much.